You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day, I understand. One day, go see the baby born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. I mean, these are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. It's just a crap to some people who were really smart made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a baller. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bow. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538, and with me in the studio, bedecked in a Toronto Blue Jays hat.
What is that about?
You know, Neil Statman Payne. Neil, what's happening on that
head? Have you no loyalty?
Over the holiday, some cousins of mine who live in Toronto gave me the hat, so I decided to wear it.
To be fair, I wore a Cubs hat last week. The
Why?
Whole office was like gasping. Because to me, the moment I put a Mets hat on, I am in. It's time for the Mets. It's time for baseball season. And right now, it's the off season, and I can sort of let the ground be fallow and run off wherever I want, and not. I don't want to have to think about the Mets yet, because once I do, my anxiety level and my emotional investment, like, there is no turning it off.
So you think that the offseason is like a hall pass for you?
This particular part of the baseball season, absolutely.
Where loyalty and monogamy aren't a thing?
And for what it's worth, I wouldn't wear a Cubs hat.
I'm not rooting for the Cubs at the moment. I'm just putting a hat on.
Okay,
what's
so
the
you
difference between the Cubs and the Blue Jays, Neil?
The
leagues?
Cubs.
Oh, get out of here with that. Please. I wouldn't put a Braves hat on. That's different.
Oh,
so
God.
Then when you wear a Mets hat, it doesn't really matter because it's just a hat?
Incorrect. My point.
Have
is
you
that
not read
during,
Chad's opus about Mets hats during, and the yeah. luck related to them?
During the baseball season, you must be loyal to your team in all attire. In the dead of the offseason, non-free agency.
You can match it with your sweater. You can match hats with sweaters.
Yeah, you got to color coordinate. That other voice you hear is Kate Fagan, ESPNW columnist and chief Barkley-ologist here at Hot Takedown. Kate, have you been following the Charles Barkley, LeBron James take-a-thon?
Hi, Chad. A little bit? A little bit. I've been following it a little bit.
Can I just take us through it real quick?
Yes, please.
There are no stats for this.
Also, there are no more pressing news stories in the world than this right now.
Listen, yeah. Neil. All right? This is a sports podcast, so we're going to talk about our own kind of nuclear warfare. Charles Barkley has always had it out for LeBron James, apparently. And recently, Charles Barkley said that James was, quote, inappropriate, whiny, all of the above. The Cleveland Cavaliers have given him everything he wanted. They have the highest payroll in NBA history, which I'm not sure is true. He wanted J.R. Smith last summer. They paid him. He wanted Iman Shumpert last summer. They brought him in. They brought in Kyle Korver. He's the best player in the world. Does he want all of the good players? He don't want to compete. He's an amazing player. They're the defending champs.
Mm-hmm.
LeBron James had enough and released his own take storm, including bringing up lots of, I would say, never quite confirmed details about Charles Barkley's life, including that Charles Barkley spit on a kid. Let me just read the LeBron quote. I'm not the one who threw somebody out through a window. I never spit
that one is confirmed, by the way.
I never spit on a kid. I never had unpaid debt in Las Vegas. I never said, quote, I'm not a role model. I never showed up to All-Star Weekend on Sunday because I was in Vegas all weekend partying. All I've done for my entire career is represent the NBA the right way. 14 years, never got in trouble, respected the game, print that. He then later went on to say that there was, quote, a new sheriff in town. Guys, how's it feel to have, you know, a couple?
It feels good.
A couple titans.
It
wrestling.
Feels good. The sad part is that Charles is no longer playing, so we can't look forward to their matchup on the court.
Right.
But other than that, it's amazing.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
I'm in favor of these kinds of takes.
And these are also like two players where their statistical records are unimpeachable. I like both players in historical standpoints. And I also thought one of the things that Barkley said, he had thrown, in addition to all the other stuff that you mentioned, Chad, he had thrown a little bit more onto this fire by saying that LeBron would never, ever be one of the five greatest players of all time, could never break through. And this was after LeBron won the championship with Cleveland over the summer. So I have to think that plays a role. You have to think think that LeBron is thinking about his place in history and just, you know, he wants that top five. He wants to break through.
All right, let's get to the show, which has no basketball in it today, somewhat miraculously. We promised you an all-Super Bowl show last week. We're not exactly going to deliver, but we will do a supersized segment on Super Bowl LI. A listener emailed in and proposed that we call it Super Bowl Lee.
Okay.
As in, like, a diminutive version of the Super Bowl, which I sort of like. So Super Bowl Lee, Falcons versus Patriots on Sunday. We will preview the whole dang thing. And then we could not talk about the Australian Open because it was such an exciting duo of finals in the women's and men's side. So 538's Carl Bialik will be along. And then our significant digit, I think we're going to do a little baseball because, you know, I want to get back in the season so I can start wearing my Mets hat.
Is it about the
again.
Cubs? It's not about the Cubs. Yeah, it's probably about the
it's
Cubs.
About those dastardly Cardinals okay. and the hacking scandal Ooh. That shook the MLB. All right, on Sunday, the New England Patriots will face the Atlanta Falcons. It is weirdly, while we were prepping for the show, I read that ESPN's Candace is their experts, quote unquote, before the playoff starts of who's going to make the playoffs. All 42, none of them said the Falcons were going to make it. Despite being the number two seed in the NFC.
How many said Patriots?
You know, Neil, I don't have that.
You don't have that in front of you.
That seemed like a good stat to bring as well,
though. More than zero.
That's fair, Kate. That's fair. But my point is, this feels, in retrospect, like a sort of march that we were always destined to be marching to this moment. I suppose that Cowboys-Packers game is the one inflection point. But, Neil, when you sit and think about this Super Bowl, Lee, From the analytics standpoint, are these the two best teams in the league according to DVOA or ELO, or you know, or are we looking at the cream of the crop here?
Yeah. So first of all, DVOA is Football Outsiders Efficiency Metric, and it stands for
defense adjusted value over average.
Oh. Come on,
it's the secret A.
How long have you been doing this?
But it should be DAVOA. Yeah. I just now realized
DAVOA.
DAVOA. This is BS.
So the Patriots do indeed rank number one in the league, or at least during the regular season they did, in DAVOA. And the Falcons were third. So sandwiched in between the two was the Dallas Cowboys, who, like you said, bowed out earlier in the playoffs. But these are two of the three best teams in the league. And if you want a second opinion, power rating wise, our ELO rating here at 538 also considers the Patriots and Falcons to be 1-2 in the league.
ELO,
so,
though, it
really is
the
cream of the
crop.
Because
if you get to the Super Bowl, it means you've beaten good teams. So
that
I
is correct,
most
Chad.
Years that ELO says it's the two best teams playing.
I don't think it happens as much as you might think. I think the last time it happened was when Denver and Seattle played in the Super Bowl.
I thought you were going to say last year.
Not last year. Yeah, right. And that one ended up actually being a one-sided blowout.
All right, Neil, question here. Mm-hmm. Because I really want to pick the Atlanta Falcons, and I have to do Around the Horn tomorrow.
And we should say the ELO percentages
don't look good
for the Falcons. 61% Patriots, 39% Falcons.
I would think 60-40 is actually probably closer than the average Super Bowl.
True.
Around about where the average Super Bowl is.
But my rational brain should probably figure out a way to articulate why I'm picking the Patriots. If I wanted to win points.
So you are picking the Patriots or you're picking the Falcons?
No, I'm picking the Falcons.
You want to pick the Falcons?
Yes. I want to pick the Falcons because the Patriots win too much. And this is a human reaction. Same reason that the Associated Press poll didn't pick UConn women's basketball as number one. They just didn't want them to be.
Voter fatigue.
Yes. I want the Falcons to win, and here is going to be my argument, and I want you to give me statistics to back it up.
Okay.
So even
that's what we're here
the best
for.
538
stories
with me.
Yeah.
No, but I do think it will get to a good place. At least I'm hoping. Or if not, I'll have good points for Around the Horn. So the Patriots defense, even though they're number one in points allowed, I think their strength of schedule, if you combine it with how they've been quote unquote lucky about missing key quarterbacks, good quarterbacks, how they've, when they've faced really tough teams, There have been certain players missing. I mean, they haven't really been tested.
Yeah.
So how, when we say they have the quote-unquote number one defense, are there any numbers like baked into that where we could pull out and be like, yeah, but maybe they have gotten quote-unquote lucky this year and we don't know how good that defense is?
Oh, no. Yeah, so that number is like complete garbage to have them ranked number one. So going back to the per-play efficiency at Football Outsiders, they have them ranked 16th best in the league. And one of the big reasons why, like you mentioned, Kate, is they played the easiest schedule of opposing offenses in the entire NFL. They were 32nd out of 32 teams in schedule strength, offensively speaking. And mainly it comes down to the pass defense. It's kind of a weird imbalance between their rush defense actually was really good. It ranked number four in Football Outsiders metric. But their pass defense ranked 23rd. And that's kind of been a running theme for the Patriots sort of in the late Tom Brady era, is they just have this kind of weak pass defense, and sometimes it works for them and sometimes it gets exposed in big games like this.
So okay.
So yeah,
so Atlanta's going to win.
Just one area of the game that we've dug into, Kate.
So okay. let's start with the offenses. Now, let's come back to the defenses, but start with the offenses.
Oh, was there an order of things you wanted to talk about and I usurped it?
You know, it's a family show.
It's a collaborative show.
According to ESPN's efficiency metric, what goes into that?
Which I'm not sure. Probably is going to be pretty much the same as Football Outsiders metric.
So it's got a Superman, Super Statman stamp?
Sure, why not?
Okay.
What does the Statman stamp look like? Is it an S?
It's got to be a little bit different.
It's like a number.
For copyright purposes.
Flown around, yeah. These are the two best offenses that are facing off at the Super Bowl.
Correct.
So,
oh, you mean like ever or this year?
No, this season.
Year.
So I want to drill into each offense, essentially. Let's start with the Falcons, where it seems as though, at least the top line headlines are that Matt Ryan and Julio Jones run things. I want to get to the running backs and how maybe they're being overlooked. But let's start with Ryan. We talked a little bit last week about how he was for real, Neil, and not going away. Is he a Brady-caliber quarterback as he's playing right now?
This particular year, is it on par with a Tom Brady year,
right?
Even if the longevity's not there?
Exactly.
Yeah, so certainly this particular year, if we're just kind of ignoring the track record of years past and looking at Matt Ryan's season compared with the other great seasons by quarterbacks in NFL history, this one is right up there. In fact, at Pro Football Reference, they have a way of kind of scaling adjusted net yards per attempt, which is the kind of ideal way to measure historical passing efficiency, at least. It gives you kind of, it's just yards per attempt, but gives you a bonus for touchdowns, penalty for interceptions and sacks and things like that. This Matt Ryan season was the fourth most efficient season passing relative to league average of any quarterback ever. If you go to Pro Football Reference, you can look at that. So the seasons that were above him were Peyton Manning in 2004, Dan Marino in 1984, and Aaron Rodgers in 2011. So Tom Brady's great 2007 season actually ranks below Matt Ryan. And we won't mention the fact that Nick Foles in 2013 ranks fifth all-time in this metric, somewhat devaluing the credibility of
that
it.
Was
we have
be
a
my
bit
question.
Of a credibility gap going on there. But if you look at the rest of the top 10, for instance, you have Mark Rippon in 91, Burt Jones in 76. That was one of those like, hey, this guy's numbers kind of look average by 2016 standards, and then it's like, oh wait, no, it happened in 1976 and nobody was passing back then, and they had to change the passing rules the next year because it was the dead ball era. Then like Joe Montana 89, Steve Young 94, Randall Cunningham 98, Brady in 2016 also shows up tied for 11th with Randall Cunningham. So just to give you a sense of Matt Ryan this year, right up there. Now before this year, not quite so much.
Right. So other than Nick Foles, that particular measurement seems to lean against one-hit wonders. So it seems to suggest that Matt Ryan's already had good years, that we might be in store for Matt Ryan putting together other quality years. Because all those quarterbacks in that ranking have longevity and numerous.
Yeah, I mean, maybe he's like, if there was a comparison that wasn't one of these all-timers that did sneak onto the list and wasn't named Nick Foles, who did it in like 250 attempts or something, is maybe Mark Rippon, because in 1991, Rippon again had this like crazy year. Washington won the Super Bowl that year.
Atlanta's going to win Super Bowl.
More evidence for you, Kate.
Thank you.
And he sort of fell off the map after that. He also, you know, missed some games within a few years and just kind of was out of football. But that's a guy who had a track record going into that year as being like pretty good and kind of a top 10 quarterback, but not like, you know, all time Hall of Fame material. And then he had that 1 year where everything was locked in. So maybe you could kind of view Matt Ryan in that capacity as well. And Burt Jones also got hurt not long after his great year. But yeah, you're right, Kate. After aside from those guys and Nick Foles, it really is just a who's who of the greatest passers of all time. And again, should mention Matt Ryan had at his best season was better than all of those other guys except the three that I mentioned.
So one of the reasons why Ryan is so good is because he has Julio Jones running around out there for him. Neil, you wrote this week about why Julio Jones is as good as he is. And one of the things that you found was that Julio Jones is uncommonly fast for how tall he is.
And uncommonly tall for how fast he is. It's kind of it's this mix.
I agree about that.
And in the story, I have like a nice little plot of 40-yard dash times, which for most receivers should be a vaguely accurate measurement of how fast they are. Certainly for some of the older ones, maybe not. But, you know, could be a decent proxy for speed and then also height. And if you kind of plot those against each other for guys that had 400 yards during the 2016 season, nobody combines speed and size like Julio Jones does and certainly did during the season when he was second in the NFL in receiving.
Well,
yards.
To be fair, it's not that he did it this season. The guy's always as fast as he is.
He's always as tall as he is at the very least.
Okay. Of the three quarterbacks higher than Matt Ryan in single season efficiency, those three quarterbacks, did they win the Super Bowl that year that they produced at that level?
No, notably they did. None of those three did. Aaron Rodgers got knocked out by your New York Giants
really
in the
riding roller coaster here, Kate.
I am. Dan Marino, emotional roller coaster.
Dan Marino lost the Super Bowl to the 49ers, I believe, and then Peyton Manning's Colts got knocked out of the playoffs by the Steelers, I want to say.
Okay.
No, it was actually by the Patriots, sorry, in the divisional round. They lost 20-3. So Tom Brady also has something of a history of kind of beating these guys, you know, these high-flying passers. At least it's a sample of one
okay.
in there.
So real quick, because I feel like we just should mention that the Devontae Freeman and Tevin Coleman, the running backs for the Falcons, are also quite good but have been overshadowed in the run-up to the Super Bowl.
So overshadowed, we overshadowed them on our show.
Yes, exactly. Good point, Neil, that I did not exactly correct that.
Just FYI, they're good
bias
too.
But we should mention that they are a big part of
the- Yeah. Well, yeah, Atlanta ranked first by far in passing efficiency, but they also ranked seventh in rushing efficiency.
They will also be
and
playing in the Super Bowl this weekend.
Oh, boy. All right, let's move on to the Patriots. I tried my best, guys. Let's move on to the Patriots, where on the offensive side, it's Tom Brady, Gronkowski's hurt, and then it's a bunch of players who aren't part of the usual suite of players that the Patriots run
You're
out
You're telling
there.
Me Chris Hogan is not a Patriots,
you know,
Ring of Honor bound player?
Or he's the most Patriots player ever.
Because he's out of nowhere?
Because he's
a
white,
he's playing well within the system.
He's like he's a taller Danny Woodhead kind of thing?
Yes.
Wes Welker.
So am I missing something that this Patriots season, this Patriots team had fewer Pro Bowlers than any of the others that have been to the Super Bowl for Bill Belichick? It seems as though it's a star and scrubs kind of setup. Is that overly facile of a narrative?
How, I think. How are they doing that? How?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they definitely have players that are good players. When I was digging into the numbers for Julio Jones, I was also looking at the types of matchups that he would have to face. So they have, for instance, a cornerback in Malcolm Butler and Logan Ryan. They have two of the best coverage cornerbacks in the NFL, according to Pro Football Focus's grades. And then, of course, Devin McCourty, perennially one of the best safeties. They also have Dante Hightower. So on defense, they actually do have some pretty good players in there. I think maybe what we're not used to is the lack of name recognition for some of the skill position players that they have right now. And of course, some of their numbers maybe during the season were depressed by the fact that Brady missed those four games at the beginning of the year, and they still ended up with really good offensive numbers. They had the second best offense, according to Football Outsiders, second only to the Falcons, of course, and they had the second best passing offense also behind the Falcons. They had the 17th best rushing efficiency rating, but you know, that kind of a quarter of the season was Jacoby Brissett and Jimmy Garoppolo and not Tom Brady. And once Brady got in there, of course, he had this crazy efficient year, 28 touchdowns, only two picks.
Let's talk about Brady a little bit beyond the stats you just laid down. It seems like this is the same Brady we've gotten in the past. And we're going to talk later on the show about old tennis stars. And here we have a version in the NFL.
I'm wondering, because I think we usually assume that an older a quarterback gets, the decline we'll see in production. I'm saying at some point we will obviously hit that with Brady, but
I mean, we assume. I don't know what the picture, what the painting in his attic looks like right now.
Perhaps because Brady.
Sorry, can we pause?
Wait, what does that mean?
Yeah, what does a painting in an attic mean?
Dorian Gray? No, nobody.
Oh, is that from that show?
No literature fans here?
Wow, Neil, that was the most high-class allusion you've ever made.
Dorian Gray. What is the show that character is in currently?
Penny Dreadful.
That's
oh, okay.
One. He's in Penny Dreadful.
Makes sense.
But I still don't understand how that has to do with Tom Brady.
Well, so in the story, there's a guy that makes some kind of, I forget the particulars, there's some kind of unnatural deal that he makes where a portrait in his attic ages and he himself doesn't actually age.
It's a Faustian bargain.
Yeah, it's kind of a Faustian bargain, and eventually he shows his, like, the painting gets destroyed and his true state it emerges, and he himself is this, like, withered, rotting corpse. So Tom Brady is exactly like that, I feel like.
Hot take down a book.
Wow.
Sure, applied to sports.
I never thought Hot Takedown and Dorian Gray would collide. And here
well,
we have
you know,
it.
You never know what will happen. But I mean,
I hadn't quite gotten to the question, but I guess right. The question was with Tom Brady, because of the system he's in, and we think of quarterbacks having these processors and making decisions quickly. What we see from Tom Brady at this point seems to be an increase in his ability each year for his mental processing of the Bill Belichick system.
It's kind of amazing because, first of all, he kind of is the system in a lot of ways. But also, he has refined it. Like you said, Kate, he's led the league in interception percentage. He didn't do it at all through age 32, which is a, you know, pretty ripe age for a quarterback. He had, you know, pretty good resistance to interceptions. But since then, going back to 2010 and then now in 2016, he's led the league four times in the span of 7 years in that particular stat. And he also, normally you would associate that type of kind of risk aversion with quarterbacks like, you know, Alex Smith, people that are sort of not taking shots down the field. But he also had one of the best touchdown percentages of any quarterback in the NFL. And you would think, oh, well, if you had like a long touchdown, you know, a lot of long passes for touchdowns, maybe you're not completing as many passes. Oh, but he also has one of the best completion percentages. So he has kind of defied Father Time in a lot of different ways and becoming this quarterback that is almost more complete now at age 39 than he was certainly a decade ago. And the only kind of warning sign that's on the horizon, like you said, Kate, eventually it's going to fall off. And what we've seen from quarterbacks that are of his ilk, Peyton Manning being, of course, the most recent example, is when the end does come, it comes very abruptly and it comes hard. But I don't think that that's something you should be on the lookout for, at least in the Super Bowl.
There's so many similarities between how we talk about Serena Williams and Tom Brady. It's like every year we're constantly like, hey, can they keep up?
Is this the year?
Well, and sorry.
No, please.
Since at least doing the show, it does seem to me like we talk about older athletes being better more than I remember older athletes being good when I was growing up, at least. I mean, I guess there was like a Wayne Gretzky, maybe just because I was 8 years old or something, and I felt like he was really old and still good. But it seems to me like the technology and the nutrition and all the rest of this maybe makes this part of how we do sports now, how we consume sports now as fans, that we're going to have longer careers for the top echelon.
I think that's because your brain processing capacity with Serena and Tom Brady gets better. And in the past, that wouldn't overcome the lack of technological advancements that allowed your body
like medicine and things like that.
Right, your body would fail before your mind did, but now your mind's still honing itself while your body is still staying at least a plateau, if not on the way down.
And maybe the only exception to that is, as we've written about a lot of times, baseball is the sport where the young kids are kind of taking over, and you see less dominance by the older athletes, and they have their own thing with performance-enhancing drugs being quote-unquote phased out of the game, and maybe that's not a coincidence, but certainly in all of these other sports, it does seem like older players are doing better than ever.
With Tom Brady, and when Neil, you were just kind of reading through his stats in terms of interceptions, but yet he still has high touchdown. What does his what do his stats look like in terms of passes over 20 yards? Because to me, that would be a correlation between interception and also throwing deep down the field.
So yeah, there's actually a stat for that, as you might expect now in today's day and age, that our friends at ESPN Stats and Info track air yards on every throw, which is the distance between the line of scrimmage and where the ball is actually caught. And so it excludes yards after the catch. And if you look at all passes, either completed or not, that were 20 or more yards downfield, Brady was the eighth most efficient passer in the NFL this season. He had a QBR of 97.7 on those passes. He completed 44% of them, which was above the league average, actually, and he also had 7 touchdowns and only 1 pick on those types of bombs. I should say, though, for your Falcon
give it to me.
That the number one most efficient deep passer, if we're talking about 20 or more yards downfield, was none other than Matty Ice.
Woo!
Matt Ryan.
They're going to win.
Who completed 50% of those passes, had 10 touchdowns, no picks, and had a 99 QBR.
I feel real good about my pick.
All right. So we know who Kate's picking. She's justified.
It's progressing throughout the show.
It's a thread throughout the Super Bowl extravaganza.
Neil, as you look at the underlying statistics, etc., do you have any reason to go against Elo and think that the Falcons are going to win? Or not? Elo's not saying the Falcons won't win. They are saying it is saying the Falcons will win 40% of the time. Do you think that it is larger than 40%, or are you willing to take the 40?
No, first of all, I think that Elo was surprising to me that Elo was right on the money with what Vegas opened up as the odds. Both had the Patriots as 3-point favorites, and our boss Nate Silver did a piece several years ago about how that's not always the case. Back in the kind of wild and wacky pre-analytics days, the Vegas line would sometimes be way out of whack with what power ratings would have predicted going into the game, and often to their credit, you know, they were more accurate in picking games, and they've kind of all sort of honed in on the same number more recently. And so I don't think there's much reason to doubt that the Patriots should be slight favorites. But does that mean that the Falcons have no chance? No, not at all. And in fact, I think that this is an interesting matchup because the two teams are in some ways mirror images of each other. If you look at their DVOA ratings, like we mentioned at the top of the show, and you kind of look at the similarities of where the teams are good and bad, this ends up being the 13th most similar matchup of the two teams in the Super Bowl out of the 47 Super Bowls that have been played since the merger in 1970. So this is an uncommonly sort of like mirror image Super Bowl of the two teams. They're really good at passing offense. They're not very good at defending the pass, so you might end up seeing one of the more pass-happy Super Bowls in history as a result of that. They're pretty good on special teams. They have all of these similarities. Now, I should also say that two similar teams. Right, I'm just adding on all of the research that I did in prep for the show.
Get it all in, dump it in.
Got to get it all in.
Before
can't
I
leave
say, all right,
anything
moving on
the cutting room floor before Chad butts in. But sometimes two evenly matched teams, according to this metric, produces a classic Super Bowl, like in 1975 when the Cowboys and the Steelers played, and they were very similar, the second most similar matchup. Other times, not so much, like in 1987, which was the most similar matchup of two teams between Denver and Washington, ended up being a snooze fest after Washington really crushed Denver from the second quarter of that game onward. So no guarantees that that's going to lead to a great game in this one, but it is interesting that the two teams are so evenly matched.
Let's
note that Neil, just an expert pivot, like, Conway level pivot where I asked him who was going to win the game, and he took it.
He didn't pick anybody.
And he moved it so quick. He went to Vegas. He went to the research that he did. He actually at one point basically said, well, I don't have to pick because the teams are basically the same. Yeah. That's where he ended up.
That's where But Kate, if you're taking the Falcons, I'll bite the bullet and I'll say the Patriots will win.
Oh, I thought you were that took a hard right turn at the end.
What a bait and switch.
Yeah, I was like, I was about to give you a high five.
No.
Psych. Neil just psych out. You on a podcast.
All right, well, I'm sticking with the Falcons.
All right, well, we'll be back in your feeds on Tuesday, listeners, to break down the whole game and whatever takes emerge out of it, because God knows there are going to be some takes.
And one more thing to
oh,
no,
my
sorry.
God. All right, moving on. Before we keep going with this week's show, let's get a word from one of our sponsors. Hot Takedown this week is sponsored by 1-800-Flowers. 1-800-Flowers has great deals on elegant and stunning bouquets that are sure to wow whomever you're celebrating on Valentine's Day. And the best part is they start at just $29.99. These breathtaking roses from 1-800-Flowers are picked at their peak and shipped overnight to ensure freshness. Simply pick your delivery date and let 1-800-Flowers handle the rest. 1-800-Flowers has exclusive offers for Hot Takedown listeners. Today's offer is 18 red roses for only $29.99, or upgrade to 24 red roses. That's six more for only $10 more, but those are only available as supplies last. So when it comes to Valentine's, do not settle for anything less than the Rose Authority, 1-800-Flowers.com. To get amazing Valentine's deals like 18 red roses for only $29.99 or upgrade to 24 for only $10 more, go to 1-800-Flowers.com. When you're there, click the radio icon and enter code TAKEDOWN. That's 1-800-Flowers.com, promo code TAKEDOWN when you click that radio icon. One more time, 1-800-Flowers.com, promo code TAKEDOWN. Why wait to wow? Order now. Okay, now on to tennis, where the first major, the first Grand Slam event of the year has completed. And it was a throwback weekend. All the finalists in both the men's and the women's brackets were over the age of 33, over the age of 35. That crew, of course, is Serena and Venus Williams and Rafael Nadal and Roger Federer. Here to talk about everything that went down is Hot Takedown's global tennis correspondent, Carl Bialik. Carl, welcome back to the show.
Just made it back from watching the Australian Open on my couch. I didn't quite make it to Melbourne this year, but I'm honored to be back.
The jet lag must be just killer after this one. So, Carl, let's start on the women's side, where Serena Williams played her sister and beat her sister 6-4, 6-4 in two sets. It seemed like sort of a classic Serena versus Venus match. It seems like maybe the last time we'll see them in the finals, though we said that in the past. Carl, what did you notice from the match? And then let's talk about Serena Williams maybe setting the record for the most Grand Slams ever.
I noticed that these are two women who are still hitting the ball and moving so well that maybe it's not the last. I don't know. I mean, a lot of things had to break right for this one, I think, especially Venus Williams ended up having a relatively straightforward draw to the final. And, you know, she's still fighting a fatigue syndrome, and it's out of her control whether that will end up interrupting her progress at a future major. But they both seem to have so much desire to keep playing, especially Venus, and they're still two of the best players in the world. I was watching after the match the 9-for-9 film about Venus Williams and equal prize money, and it showed some of her early finals. And I think she was hitting the ball harder and maybe moving at least as well in this one. You know, the sport's evolved as well, but I think we're seeing that the Williams sisters are still really, really hard to beat at Grand Slams.
So this was Serena's record 23rd Grand Slam championship. Some places are reporting that as a record, as I just said, as an open-era record. And then, but there's Margaret Court, who won 24 Grand Slam titles, which is more than Serena's 23. What's the truth? What, or is it an alternative fact, Carl?
The truth is that tennis stats are really annoying and complicated. I mean, here's a sport that had this amazingly dramatic change relatively late in its life. Well, hopefully its life continues for long from now, but in its lifespan so far, in 1968, it went from amateur to professional. And a lot of people use that as a demarcating line for records. it's also the case, and somewhat related but not, that tennis has just gotten much tougher. It's gotten more international. The draws have gotten bigger. So a lot of Margaret Court's titles came at the Australian Open, and the ones before.
She herself is Australian.
She is. And often almost everyone or everyone in the draw with her was Australian. And as good as Australians were at tennis, that's just not the same thing as winning a draw now of 128 players from all over the world, really the best pool of talent that tennis has ever had, relative to a time when it was Margaret Court and the next 31 best Australians.
Carl, I don't know if you saw this from the press box in Melbourne, but Michael Jordan actually sent Serena a pair of Jordans that she wore during that final match against Venus, and they had the 23 on them for 20. I just had to throw that out there because
that's fun.
I like Jordans.
Is Nike sponsoring this episode?
No, but I want Nike to sponsor me, so I mention them as frequently as I possibly can. It feels like over the last few years, and even going back farther, that we've tried to create so many storylines, and so many storylines exist about Serena. Like, is she the greatest women's player? Is she the greatest player of all time? Is she done? What now going forward, like, what are we supposed to do? How are we supposed to talk about Serena without feeling like we're just falling into a pit of cliches?
That's a great question. I do think Margaret Court's record is still a real thing that we can talk about, partly because when Steffi Graf was looking like she would never not win another major, people were saying 24 is the target for her after she passed Chris Evert and Martina Navratilova. So it's an annoying record. It's not really comparable. If they met at their best, Serena Williams would win easily, clearly. But that's certainly a target, and she and her coach have indicated that they kind of are wanting to have it both ways. On the one hand, oh, that's not real. On the other hand, we totally want that. We totally want 25. 25 is also a really nice number. Beyond that, I think another weird thing about her career is that for much of it, she was not number one in the world. So we can still talk about her maybe having the most weeks at number one. She just regained it by winning this tournament, and that's another way to sort of cement without a doubt for anyone who still has doubts, and I hope there aren't many out there, that she is the greatest women's tennis player of all time.
And what did you see, not just in the championship match with Venus, but maybe throughout the Australian Open, that could lead you to discuss whether or not you think she could win a Grand Slam this year, which is always a topic? What did we see from her across the 2 weeks that would project forward for her this year?
She was about as dominant as she's ever been at a Grand Slam, which is just remarkable given that she's a few months past 35. I think as much as that is impressive, it's still also somewhat doubtful if she can maintain that, because even when she won four in a row a couple of years ago, she was having a lot of tough matches kind of out of nowhere against players we wouldn't be worried about. I think what I saw even more to be encouraged by in terms of her chances is that the players we would have think as her biggest rivals really in the next three majors never really showed up, didn't get to the point where she even had to play them. So the women's game beyond the Williams sisters and somewhat Angelique Kerber is really, really inconsistent, and that could create some open draws.
And I couldn't help but think about Venus during all of this, and sort of we see this a lot in sports, and I'm curious what you think about this, of being the player that sort of, if it were not for this other better player, and in this case their sisters, as like a roadblock to you winning, what would her career have been like? And maybe this is an impossible question to even kind of hypothesize
about. And
still,
we want you to hypothesize.
But still do it. If her sister had not sort of been there, and she, you know, early in her career, she won four of the first five finals at Grand Slams that she played, and then she just ran into the Serena buzzsaw, and kind of that's, she's only beaten her once in a final since then and lost countless times. So,
well, they're countable.
They are countable. I don't have the number right in front
so
of me.
So Serena's like Carl Malone.
Yeah,
I mean Venus is
yeah,
like
or Charles Barkley or anyone like that.
Real quick, Serena is 7-2 against Venus in Grand Slam.
Right, that's the counting. Chad has done the counting.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And while you know you were joking that it can't really be answered, I've done this calculation on the men's side before because, for instance, Andy Roddick was blocked so many times by Roger Federer. Federer was blocked many times by Nadal. Nadal many times by Djokovic. It's absolutely the case for Venus Williams. I mean, the first time Serena Williams won four in a row, I think all four finals were against her sister, You could say that Venus Williams almost won four in a row, almost out of Venus.
Jed wants to interrupt
you.
Can
we just say, blocked is like a remarkable euphemism to wasn't, or was it better than? Yeah, like it's blocked, quote unquote, but actually it's just that someone was better. Sports works where someone wins.
Sure. Right, but do we think that tennis maybe is more kind of...
Matchups are important.
Right, exactly. Like the way in which the best player beats the second best player, that
and
happens
we do.
A lot more
and
often.
We do. Right? Yeah. We talk about Charles Barkley, if not for Michael Jordan.
Carl Malone was just mentioned.
There are generations of
it makes more sense in the Venus Serena discussion because
right, exactly.
There was one singular player that blocked her versus like Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, Roddick. There's like, okay, right, so he got blocked by every good player above
him. If there's a bunch of different players beating you, I think it makes less sense to say that you were blocked.
Right.
But if it's one person that's always just there and better than you, I think that's fair.
Yeah, so one example is Federer's only French Open was in 2009, and Nadal lost early. It was the only time he lost until 2 years ago at the French Open in his career. Most people think if Nadal made that final, Federer wouldn't have won. Nadal blocked Federer at the French Open. I take your point, Jad, completely. I also think another counterargument is, and Venus and Serena will both say this, if each one didn't have the other growing up and throughout their careers, would they even still be playing now? Would they ever have achieved what they did? Obviously, their parents were very important too, but the fact that there were two sisters who were both so good and pushing each other was really important.
All right, let's move on to the men's side now, where Roger Federer beat Rafael Nadal in a 5-set match. I did not watch it from what I understand, partly because it was on at 3:30 in the morning or whatever, but from what
Sorry,
I understand,
ESPN.
It was an incredible sort of match of long rallies at times and up and down, back and forth play. Carl, same question that we started the women's side with. You know, what did you see in these two competitors who've been playing each other for so long?
Well, one thing that really strikes me, and we were just talking about how important matchups are in the sport, and the way that these two play, even though they haven't played in a Grand Slam final in almost 6 years, they hadn't played at all in over a year, and one of them's 35 and the other one's 30 and has had enough injuries to last, you know, a sports career in Nadal, they still look like themselves. It just looked like a Federer-Nadal match. There were subtle differences, and they were crucial to Federer winning, but you wouldn't watch that match and think this was a total fluke. They're never going to make it back here. Nadal couldn't win the French. Federer couldn't win Wimbledon. And it's also, I think, really fun in this sport in particular when you have two players who have played 34 times before like these two in so many important matches to see how they do try to adjust slightly. So you mentioned long rallies. When there were long rallies in this one, as usual, it favored Nadal. Federer, more than I've ever seen him before against Nadal, really shortened rallies even with his backhand. Nadal attacks the backhand. That's the pattern. Federer hit his backhand hard and aggressively and won the point a lot in a way he hadn't before, and that ended up being crucial in the match.
A couple of years ago, or maybe even if it was as recently as last year, we were talking about whether Nadal was done. And there's another player now that seems to be going through that same cycle in Novak Djokovic. I'm not sure if you have any insight into, like, even if you're, you know, armchair, like, psychiatrist here on Djokovic, what's going on with him? Because, I mean, I have my own kind of personal take, but I'd love to hear what you think, whether you think Djokovic is just kind of going through a reorientation in his career or whether he's really hit a roadblock.
Yeah, I think it's probably a reorientation mixed with a little bit of he is, you know, turning 30 this year, and so he probably kind of fought off aging decline for a while, but eventually it catches up to you. But as Federer shows, when you decline from being one of the best or the best of all time, you're still going to be really good. And it's not like Djokovic is losing everywhere. He just beat Andy Murray coming into this tournament. He made the final of the World Tour Finals in London. He made the final of the U.S. Open. He's not really looking injured. So I actually want to hear your take, because this is a mystery right now in the sport.
Right, because the last two majors is really where it's...
Well, Wimbledon and this one.
Yeah, and this one.
Yeah.
Where he hasn't looked so good. I think my take is coming in hot here on Hot Takedown, is that I think we saw Serena have to figure out once you had achieved the number one and you'd won every single Grand Slam, like, how do you motivate yourself again? It was a question that we talked about with, like, Ronda Rousey. What's her motivation to get back to the top when you've already been at the top? And perhaps for Djokovic, it looks like it could be something similar. He finally completed the career Grand Slam. He's had so many weeks at number one. Now what is the motivation to continue being as great and living the way he was living to get to that point? And I think you can find it again, because we saw Serena somehow find that extra level of motivation. So that's my distant take on Novak Djokovic and kind of motivation motivation level that he has to achieve again.
Yeah, and it makes a lot of sense. I sort of saw his motivation as bottomless and didn't see this coming, basically. Even when he won the French Open last year, and that was four in a row, I thought, now he's got a great chance to win the Grand Slam. In fact, a lot of people thought he would. Now, he won four in a row. Some call that the Grand Slam. But if he won four in a row in the same season, first time on the men's side since 1969, it would have been an even more incredible accomplishment. Also would have been six in a row overall. He also is chasing Federer's 17, which is now 18. And I thought that motivated him enormously. He's still two behind Nadal and Sampras. So I guess I just didn't see it coming that finally winning the French, winning four in a row, that could potentially be a block. I also think we're talking about such small margins in the sport. I mean, he lost to Sam Querrey in a tiebreaker in the fourth set. He lost to Dennis Istomin in this tournament in five sets. Fifth set was close. Those matches could have gone the other way. Federer and Nadal both won matches that were kind of that close in this tournament. And then you just completely rewrite the narrative.
So I had one more question, Carl, about just the big picture of the Australian Open in general. Was this sort of the most prestigious final, if you include both sides, ever in like a major, or, you know, or have there been other ones?
The combined ELO ratings,
yeah,
of each
like
player?
If we could like kind of average together or something like that.
Very
yeah.
Neil question.
You know, it's not countless, but it hasn't been counted by me. We could call it uncounted, but I think it's got to be number one or close, just because if you talk about the number of majors the players already had at that
right.
point,
mm-hmm.
then yes. I mean, there have been great finals, and then later the players go on to great careers.
Like
then
we find
back.
Out later
exactly.
it was prestigious.
How many combined majors was in the men's and women's?
60 heading in, 62 now.
Wow.
Well, yeah. So, you know, I think in terms of their level right now, certainly not the best.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really impressed with their level right now, but still you got to look at all of the last year and their struggles and injuries. But yeah, in terms of sum total of accomplishments they've already achieved, and then to add two more titles to that quartet, it was an incredible weekend.
And listeners, you can read some of Carl's work on 538 about how this quartet of players in the finals wasn't just very accomplished, but was also some of the oldest, I think, ever. And as a result, the average age of tennis in the finals had been dragged up, because as these players get old, they're still good, and you can still see that. Carl, real quick. We've had this conversation off the mic, but I just want to note for any other listeners who are out there who were also confused, the logo of the Australian Open this year was an A and an O, understandable.
Mm-hmm,
the A
mm-hmm.
was lacking the crossbar of the A, okay?
Right.
So it was just
crucial part of the A.
It was essentially a teepee.
Kind of makes the A.
It was
yeah,
a teepee,
yeah.
Okay? And the O was a very bold, thick-stroked, perfect circle, all right?
Yeah, that's
every
confusing.
Time, okay, confusing on its own. Then, Neil, if you could please pull up for Kate to see, if you could Google the show The OA, a new show on Netflix. Also
I
not
love
a
that
sponsor,
show.
Not a sponsor of this
it's
program.
It's exactly the
it's
same.
It's the same logo.
Except
with the
interchange.
Except with the letters transposed.
That is, I love that show.
Chad had me on today just to bring this up.
So every time I was watching the Australian Open, I thought, wait, the OA is sponsoring the Australian Open? No, that's just the Australian Open. Listeners, if you thought the same, I just need to know
Let
that
us
someone
know.
Else out there had this experience. I feel very alone.
Chad, you have been pushing this for
but this
at least
is sort of what the OA is about, right?
Are we going to put it in the 538.com show notes on the website?
Some logo side by sides? We can do that.
In
absolutely.
My perfect world, the producer of the show is a huge tennis fan is going to contact you after.
Yeah, sure. Exactly.
Explain it.
Excellent. All right. Carl Bialik, as always, pleasure to have you. Thanks.
Nice being here. Thank you.
Okay, now on to our significant digit. When a telling number from the world of sports is brought to us, dropped down from on high, in this case, dropped down from the commissioner's office, because our significant digit this week is $2 million, 56 and 75. Can we have three significant digits? I think that's not quite
triple
allowed.
Significant digits.
Those are the numbers that the MLB office handed down to the St. Louis Cardinals as a penalty, $2 million in cash, and the number 56 and 75 overall picks in the MLB draft. And that penalty is for a really remarkable, bizarre hacking scandal within baseball, in which someone within the St. Louis Cardinals front office hacked into Houston's scouting database several years ago and stole something. We're not entirely sure mm-hmm. what. We think it may have been a player evaluation system. We think it may just have been some potential trade
or
talk,
draft or targets. Or
yeah,
something
of who the Astros were going for. But there was some general manager switching between the two teams.
And then there was even another twist today in which someone accused the Astros of having done it first and the Cardinals did it in retaliation.
I think
retaliation.
Someone was the guy who...
The guy who actually went to jail. Yeah.
Okay. So, but I bring this up because Neil answered a question for me that I was curious about, which is what sport is it best to cheat in? Where are you going to get the lightest penalty as far as what's going to hurt your team down the line? And Neil, you ran the numbers and it turns out...
Yeah, so we should preface this by saying this was the first time anything like this has actually happened in Major League Baseball in terms of like draft pick penalties being levied. And I should also say that this doesn't take into account the fact that they lost about $2 million out of their bonus pool in addition to the draft picks, like you mentioned at the top of the segment. But if you just look at those picks and the kind of value of that, losing those particular picks would drop a team's odds of winning at least one World Series over the course of a decade by 1.4 percentage points.
That's pretty significant.
It is significant. But if you look at some of the other penalties that were given out for other scandals in the NFL and the NBA, so the Patriots in Deflategate, they lost two picks, the number 29 pick and a fourth round pick. And the cost of those particular picks would drop a team's odds of winning the Super Bowl over a 10-year span by 4 percentage points.
That's more than 1.4.
That is correct. Even with Spygate, when they lost a first-round pick in the 2008 draft, that would cost you 3.2 percentage points. So in the NFL, it seems like a little bit of a
stiffer
penalty.
Can you add those two together and say that the Patriots have lost seven?
Well these are separate scandals, but yeah, you could say.
At some point, they were 7% down. They still won in that span.
The Bounty Gate, one more from the NFL, when the Saints had the bounty scandal.
Neil put research this by just searching gate.
Anything that ended in gate with that suffix. That was the one that had the biggest of the three that I looked in the NFL. That would cost a team 4.4 percentage points of Super Bowl probability. But the biggest one of all came in the NBA when, and I don't know if you remember this from about 15 years ago, Kate, but the Minnesota Timberwolves tried to get around the salary cap by having a secret contract agreement with Joe Smith, the very deeply average NBA forward Joe Smith.
Wasn't he a number one pick?
He was a number one overall pick in 1995 out of Maryland and ended up being just kind of this like
secret contract.
So they, Kevin McHale, the GM of the T-Wolves, wanted Joe Smith, but they wanted to also have cap flexibility. So they had him sign the series of one-year deals at like way below market rates on the promise that after the term of those deals was up, they would give him a longer term deal worth like more than he was worth on the market. So it would kind of even out for him. But they needed like those particular years to sign, certain players, and they couldn't do it under the cap unless they did this weird kind of behind closed doors mechanism. So when the league caught wind of this, they took away five first round picks from the Minnesota Timberwolves,
wow,
which in the NBA is an enormous penalty. Now, for good behavior, they ended up reinstating the Timberwolves picks in 2003 and 2005, but they still lost three first round picks. And if you did that over a 10-year period, you would lose 6.5 percentage points off of your odds of winning.
I thought it would be higher than that.
Yeah, I think because of the picks.
That was with the three, not the five, right?
The three picks.
Didn't the Miami Heat kind of do the same thing with Dwayne Wade?
I think there were rumblings, but nothing was ever penalized.
And also, I just want to applaud you, Neil, because I have no concept of how you would even start to get those numbers.
It involves a lot of like draft value cheat sheets.
Because like, I can kind of understand when you're like, Tom Brady's, quarterback rating. I can kind of understand how that happens in my head, but like that, I have no clue how that happened.
Leave it in the street.
Statman
never revealed.
Mysterious cape.
Right. But the reason why it wasn't worse.
And also.
Wow, I thought we were done, but
well, those picks were actually not even that good. Like, we talk about the NBA as having this very steep curve where like the top picks at the top of the draft turn out to be stars, and it very rapidly diminishes as you kind of go deeper into the first round, to the point that second round picks are not really worth that much at all, with the exception of like your Manu Ginobili's. These were the number 13 overall pick, the number 23 overall pick, and the number 28 overall pick. So these are kind of shitty picks, I mean, to be honest.
So this will be our third segment, and then we'll do a Sig Dig.
We promised our listeners.
Sig Dig will be tennis.
An all Super Bowl show. What do we give them? We gave them
tennis,
like
basketball, LeBron, Barkley.
Oh, man. You know, we just really follow through. That'll do it for this week's show. Thanks to Kate Fagan. Kate, always a pleasure.
What's my other name?
What do you mean?
What was my other attribute?
Chief Barkleyologist?
Yes, thank you.
Oh, that's a good one.
Thank you, Chad.
I did it at the top of the show.
Usually you reiterated at the bottom.
Sorry. So sorry.
Okay. I like it so much, I want it twice.
Thanks to our Chief Barkleyologist, Kate Fagan, and Stat Man himself, Neil Payne.
Now our listeners know to take us both literally and seriously.
Whew. Our podcast producer is Katie Ferguson. Our podcast chief executive is Jody Avergan. Our intern is Kara Chin. We got production assistance from Tony Chow and Jorge Estrada. You can email us at podcasts@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. You can find us on your favorite podcasting app and, of course, on iTunes as well. iTunes.com/538. While you're there, be sure to review and or rate the show. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.